This is Dr. Will Tuttle, your host of the Worldwide Vegan Summit for Truth and Freedom. We are now having the valuable opportunity to learn from the remarkable experience and the inspiring example of Derek Brose. He's a freelance investigative journalist, activist, author, and public speaker originally based in Houston, Texas, now living in Mexico. He's the author of 5 books, most recently the Conscious Resistant Trilogy, and How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State. Derek is also the writer and narrator of a dozen documentary film projects, including a 16-part documentary series entitled The Pyramid of Power. Additionally, Derek has been a longtime proponent of the concept of freedom cells and is a co-founder of the Freedom Cell Network. He has helped grow the online network to more than 25,000 people worldwide. Derek is also the co-founder of the Greater Reset Activation, a solutions-focused event providing opportunities for pushing back against the Great Reset agenda. Derek is an anarchist and a vegan who believes in the liberation of all species. So I am really delighted that we have this precious opportunity to have you with us, Derek, and I know you're extremely busy with a lot of online activities, and you're heading out on the road, too. And as a vegan, bringing your awareness to what's happening not only to animals but to human animals as well right now, I was wondering if you could, just in the beginning here, tell a little bit about your journey and why veganism for you not only includes non-human animals but human animals and how that affects what's happening to us right now.
Sure. Thank you for having me on. First of all, I appreciate that, and thanks to everybody who's tuning in. As far as, you know, finding my way to veganism, I think it was a combination of health factors and the moral aspect, you know, the ethical aspect of it. It really started in, I'd say, 2007, 2008. I started experiencing some really bad stomach and kind of digestion issues, intestinal issues, and at 25 years old, I had to go get a colonoscopy because I was just having so much issues. And the doctor proposed a very invasive surgery to try to fix my situation, which was not only super invasive and didn't sound like the kind of procedure I wanted to go through at the time, but also was out of my financial range. You know, I couldn't afford it. And so he suggested, well, then start trying to be a vegetarian because that'll be easier on your stomach and your digestion and just all the stuff I had going on. So that was one of the first things that started to get me generally to think about my health and, you know, from that perspective. But also at the same time, pretty much, yeah, that around that time I became friends with a cat, and he ended up becoming my best friend for 10 years. And he passed away about a year and a half ago. And basically I end up, you know, just as I was beginning my activist journey, I had come out of prison and I was a felon now, and I was spending a lot of time at the library and a lot of time at home because I couldn't get a job because of my felony, basically. Because of that, I ended up spending a lot of time with this cat, and he just became like my best friend. And we, you know, he just traveled with me everywhere, all over the country and all over the city. And as silly and simple as that sounds, it was pretty much that at one point that caused me to go from being vegetarian to just, you know, as I discovered more about veganism, to realizing that culturally, I could have been born in a different country and my best friend would be food, right? And I could be born in a different part of the world and all of a sudden I'm eating somebody else's best friend. And it was just that kind of clicked for me. And I just thought, you know what? I don't want to eat anybody's best friend. I don't want to eat anybody, any other sort of life that has its own existence and its own emotions and desires and all that good stuff. And it was just, yeah, it was just kind of like that clicked for me. And that was, yeah, about 10 years ago, 10, 11 years ago, vegetarianism about 12 years, so shortly after that, veganism. And that's kind of just where it started for me. And then along the journey of my activism, I definitely did start to, as I discovered that I'm an anarchist, which doesn't mean, you know, I want violence or anything of that sort. It just means that I think that people are free to, generally, you know, anarchists think of it as, oh, human beings are free to decide their own choices. We don't need government or these hierarchies, these centralized institutions. And for me, as already being a vegan, it just kind of felt naturally like to go further and say, well, yeah, I mean, I guess if there's a vegan anarchist, I guess that's me. And even it's interesting that even within the anarchist community, you have some of the same debates that people have outside of it, where the vegan anarchists feel like they have the most strong moral position of like, all right, guys, you got the anarchist thing. You recognize government's immoral in our view, but you're still eating meat. You're still subjugating animals, you know, and to other vegan anarchists, however you say it, people have these different terms. I think that it really is just the moral argument that government is immoral and violence against humans, forcing that on people is wrong, but also extending that to animal life. And, you know, people have differing perspectives within there. But that's sort of where I fall within that range, is I haven't explicitly in the last 10 years really made veganism part of my activism. You know, if obviously I talk to people know I'm vegan. I've mentioned it before. I've done a few videos, but it hasn't become like the focal point of my activism. And I do feel more recently called to voice that a bit louder. I don't think it'll ever be the only form of activism I take, because I think honestly, whether you're talking about veganism or anything else, that single issue politics or single issue activism falls short, because there's so much interconnectedness between all the different issues, like some of the things we're going to talk about today. And for me, definitely looking at the exploitation of animals and the way that that system is destructive to me ties into the way that humans are exploited. And, you know, some people from their human perspective can say, I don't want to be subjugated. I don't want to be put in a cage. I don't want to be treated this way, but then turn around and treat animals the same way. And so they haven't really made the connection, where some of us are like, hey, look, don't you see, you know, the same thing. But yeah, that's sort of where my veganism and anarchism and political journey lies.
Right. Yeah. I know you're so right. I mean, once you make that connection, it's really hard to go back when you see that human domination and exploitation and oppression of other living beings. And then we think, well, you know, I don't want to be oppressed, but I love a good burger. So I'm really glad that you're doing that. But, you know, you are remarkable to me in the energy and the amount of outer work that you're doing and have been doing in creating the Greater Reset Activation, which has been two major events there, and the Freedom Cell Network. And so really bringing the vegan, which I think of as the vegan ideal of the liberation of all animals, including human animals. So what we're seeing now in the last year and a half or so with this whole COVID is something really new. And can you talk a little bit about your view of the Greater Reset, what that is? Maybe you can just say a little bit. I think a lot of people are maybe vaguely aware of that, but if you can just talk a little bit about what you see the Greater Reset being and why it's so dangerous for us and maybe for animals too.
Sure. So, I'll distinguish in case folks aren't familiar with the term. So the Greater Reset is the event that I helped organize, which is a response to the Great Reset, the Great Reset is I think a simple way to put it is a marketing campaign is what it really comes down to. But it's not just a marketing campaign by Coca-Cola or something like that to sell you some new product. I mean, in a way, it is to sell you a product, but the product is kind of a embracing of a new normal, as they put it. You know, the hashtag new normal that's been going around since the very beginning of COVID. And that phrase, the Great Reset, was first floated by the World Economic Forum, which is, you know, one of these kind of non-governmental organizations. They're just a think tank, a nonprofit is what they describe themselves as the International Organization for Public and Private Cooperation. Their goal is to foster more public-private partnerships, which probably at their best, and maybe with good people involved, can be something that could provide value to the community, where you would have cooperation from governments or state, you know, entities with private entities and doing good for the public. But unfortunately, it's often not playing out that way in practice. And really, when you think about that, the idea of the merger or the partnership of public, state, and private power, it's very, and this, I don't mean this in like any hyperbole, this is just what the definition is. The definition of fascism as well is the merger of corporate state power. So it's just interesting that a lot of these things that they're promoting, I don't know, they hem close to some of these older ideologies. But after COVID started to take place, the World Economic Forum launched this marketing campaign, The Great Reset, and they were, you know, using flashy memes. They hired graphic designers and just started putting it out there. You started seeing Prince Charles talk about it. You started seeing Joe Biden talk about it. Different politicians, John Kerry, different politicians around the world, Australia, using the same language, the same terminology. And many of us were paying attention, like, look, the World Economic Forum is saying it's time to, you know, reset our world. COVID has proven that our systems are broken, which I would agree they are, but some of the same people who, you know, helped break them are kind of saying, hey, we've got the solution now. Let us lead the way. Right. And so they have presented themselves, the World Economic Forum and other organizations, as the leaders who are going to help us find our way out of COVID by supporting this Great Reset. And specifically, they're calling for a Great Reset of capitalism. And Klaus Schwab, who's the head of the World Economic Forum, he published a book, COVID-19, The Great Reset, came out in June 2020. So about March, we started hearing the language. We started seeing some of the videos. And, you know, the World Economic Forum, again, is not just some random organization. They were one of the first organizations to start talking about vaccine passports before any of us had ever heard that term. It was like they were kind of predicting what was to come and saying, hey, could this be the way to go back to normal? Is this, will this allow travel to resume? And many of us were paying attention and saying, guys, look, this is what these folks have planned. And, you know, it's written about in Klaus Schwab's book. They basically are saying that this is an opportunity, whatever your thoughts on COVID, these, you know, technocrats, which is essentially just means people who are in technology fields or also in scientific fields, essentially believing that we should have rule by experts, that they are the ones that are smart enough, intelligent enough to make decisions for the whole, whether that means, hey, you shouldn't eat meat or you should, you know, get a vaccine, whatever it means. They think that they're just the ones that are smart enough to make those choices for us. And they are pushing for this idea of a great reset. It's time to reset our medical systems, our healthcare systems. And they propose these things in a lot of flowery, appealing language, mostly buzzwords, but things that if somebody isn't very well informed and doesn't really know who these people are or what their other motives are, then it sounds like a really positive thing. It's like, yeah, the world is broken. These people are proposing, let's make it better. COVID's showing us how weak our healthcare system, how weak the government is and how weak, et cetera, you know, and the solution is, well, we need a great reset. We're all going to create a more sustainable, just, diverse, equitable world. Again, a lot of buzzwords that appeal to people's emotions, but in practice don't always turn out that way.
Right. Like they always say, we're going to build back better.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the terminology. Yeah. And I mean, just as an example, so folks can better understand it. So I'm originally from Houston. I still keep up with what's going on in Houston because Houston is the fourth largest city in the U.S. and it definitely plays a major role in rolling out some of these things. The way that these agendas, they come into place is from top down, you know, like it's like a pyramid structure. And so at the top level or somewhere near the top, let's say the World Economic Forum, Great Reset, they start floating that idea, the new normal terminology. And then you start seeing it popping up in articles in the media. You start seeing heads of state, politicians and other people using the language, including Build Back Better. And it gets all the way down to the local level. So the mayor of Houston, he actually just this last week was a part of the Build Back Better tour in Houston where they had the Democratic Party, I guess they're traveling the country and promoting the ideas of the Great Reset. He also is a part of the Resilient Cities Network, which is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, which is specifically aimed at implementing a lot of these ideas of the Great Reset, also what has previously been called Agenda 2030, which comes from the United Nations. And I know that this is like a lot of information that for some folks it might be new or it could kind of sound a little, you know, quirky or overwhelming, but I encourage you to do the research and to look into these topics because, again, the United Nations Agenda 2030 goals, Sustainable Development Goals, they promote things that many of us might support if done in a voluntary fashion, if done in a way that does respect people's rights and that doesn't end up where you have less rights, but the environment's protected, right? Well, you can't go anywhere. You can't do anything. We can tell you when to travel, et cetera. And that's some of the, you know, just a peek at some of the reality that these folks promote, these technocrats. And so they're not really using the term Agenda 2030 anymore, but it's really the same thing. Some people used to call it, you know, the New World Order. I think that term's kind of like a little bit, you know, divisive or whatever, but whatever you want to call it, at the moment they're calling it the Great Reset. And that is what led myself and some other activists to create the Greater Reset and say, like, look, these people are putting it out there, they're writing books about it, they're talking about this is their opportunity to reset, remake the world, and do it in this equitable, sustainable world. But really, the world they describe is moving towards the fourth industrial revolution, the Internet of Things, the Internet of Humans, the Internet of Bodies. These are all real world concepts. Most of us are just familiar with, oh, we got cell phones, but they imagine and predict and expect a world where there is digital surveillance is kind of all pervasive, facial recognition, whatever it may be, where you're literally living on the net, on the web, and it would entail the loss of privacy as we know it, but it might be better for the environment, they promise. It, you know, might be more just or fair or these kinds of things, but it could also involve the loss of individual choice, the loss of freedom of movement. And if we look to places like China that already have a lot of this technocratic system, particularly things like a social credit score, then it can get really bad. It could be like, even for us as vegans, you might be in a situation where we want to encourage people to not eat meat, obviously, and to not hurt animals. But what if it became a state-sanctioned system that said that, you know, this was now the law, and anybody who kind of stepped outside of that, whether it's veganism or in China, for example, littering, anything that is they see as antisocial, your social credit score could go down. That could determine whether or not you can travel, whether you can fly, whether you get that bonus vacation, or whether you, you know, can do anything. And China has specifically said they want it to be possible that they can prevent any sort of antisocial behavior at all. And if somebody attempted to persist with antisocial behavior, that they wouldn't even be able to take a single step outside of their home, that they would essentially be confined there because their social credit score would go down, and that would be connected to a digital ID. And again, I know this can sound pretty fantastical, but think about what we're seeing with calls for vaccine passports. Many of us believe that those are just the beginning of implementing an international, probably global eventually, but a digital ID that won't just have your COVID information. It'll eventually have your banking information, everything all in one. And that'll seem very simple and very useful and convenient, but it also could lead to a time where that and whatever information is on there, whatever you've been rated based on your behavior, which is being monitored at all times, could determine the level of privileges, what we used to call rights, that you have, you know. And that for me is a very scary prospect, but we're seeing that already play out in places like Paris and Australia and other places where they can't, some people now being denied going into supermarkets to shop for food because they're not vaccinated. You know, these sorts of situations could get worse. And it's not even about the vaccine. It could be any other arbitrary category they claim. If they say, hey, well, you said something bad about the government on social media, well, now your score's down and you don't have enough points to come in the grocery store. You know, it could realistically get to that point in the not too distant future. And this is the world that they are calling for with the Great Reset.
Right. So there, what you're saying is that they're kind of sugarcoating and making it somewhat appealing by saying everything will be well organized and we'll be able to take better care of the environment, and it seems like it's basically like a technocratic's dream, sort of like we have this, instead of having a rule by people and sort of the messy politics that we're used to and trying to have a life where we have relative economic freedom, you're basically switching to something where there's just a few people who are experts and they decide, and there's really nothing you can do about it. So how do you feel, I mean, this is the Great Reset, and this is mainly, you didn't really mention it, but I think we all know, these are mainly very wealthy people, right? This is a lot of money behind this. This is big wealth is how they get in. They have a lot of money. What is the positive response to this? What do you think people can do positively in response to this, besides learning about it, which I think is huge, just making an effort to understand, but actually what we can do? Because I know you're involved in positive responses, and I'd love to hear more about that too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always important, I think, to obviously we got to educate each other, but to what are the solutions, right? What can we do about it? And you're also correct that this is mainly coming from the, you know, ultra rich, wealthy. They actually refer to themselves as the Davos class, because the World Economic Forum is typically held every year in Davos, Switzerland. So it's definitely, we're dealing with people who are, I'd say, pretty out of touch with the average person's experience, and truly see themselves as the ones who need to make our choices. And as far as what we can do about it, as you mentioned, the first step is education, right? I mean, there's, besides this conversation, I've written articles and put out a mini documentary about the Great Reset. You can find that at my website if you want to learn more and, you know, get into that stuff. But once you get to the point where you're like, okay, I get it. I understand what's happening. I see it. It's staring me in the face. It can be a very unnerving feeling. I've met a lot of people over the last year who are very, you know, they're afraid. They're kind of really concerned with the direction the world is going in at the moment, even more than they maybe had been prior to COVID. And are really seriously thinking, like, what can we do? I mean, we've just seen the world turning upside down, that people are, I think, confused, even if they feel like they don't trust the story that they're being told, they're just not sure what to do. And it can be a disempowering thing. One thing I would say, first of all, is just to recognize that you truly are not alone. I mean, I think that those of us who were able to participate or even just watch the Greater Reset, really, we did it in January, as you mentioned, we did it two times, January and May, we're doing it again in the coming January. And we've just been able to connect with people from all around the world, reaching out to us and sharing their messages of, you know, giving thanks to us, but more than that, inspiring us by telling us all the projects they're working on. Hey, we met some locals. We're starting to grow our own food. We pulled our kids out of school. We're homeschooling, or, you know, we have local homeschool pods now, or just different things like that. There really, truly are so many of us around the world who are paying attention to what's happening and are trying to think in terms of solutions. So that's one thing to say is like, don't be consumed by too much fear, because that's easy to happen. But there definitely are a lot of good people. I think one of the main ways I keep myself motivated with all the work I do is just because I do have the opportunity to work with so many amazing people like yourself. And I just sort of, in my weak moments, I take solace in knowing like, okay, there's so many awesome people out there. Like when I need a moment to rest, they're still pushing, you know, when they need a moment to rest, I'll be there. Right. It's just, there's so many of us. So recognize that you're definitely not alone. The other thing is I do encourage people to check out the Freedom Cells Network and Freedom Cells website, freedomcells.org, but not even just our website. If there's any other websites out there or communities that you feel like you're connecting with people locally, that's all that really matters. Like, we're just trying to help people find people in their community, because it's important for us to have these conversations and to know what our brothers and sisters in India and Australia and Germany and the U.S. and Mexico are doing. But what ultimately matters is the people that are in our communities, right? Because I think that the key to surviving and thriving in this sort of technocratic world that these folks are trying to create is community. I mean, we truly cannot do this alone. Like, if this technology continues to roll in the trajectory that it's in, it could be very easy to lock out one person, right? And if that one person is isolated and you can't get into the grocery store anymore, or you're locked out of this business, or you can't come to work, you know, it could become very difficult to just to survive. But if we are coming together in communities, and whether that means you live in the same neighborhood, you live in the same city, or some people want to go buy land together, whatever it may mean for you when you think of that idea, community, the goal of it is to have a support network of people that you can trade together. Y'all can share knowledge, share skills. You can grow food together. You can learn about permaculture. You know, whatever your particular interests are, that's all we've been trying to do with Freedom Cells over the last few years. And we've seen an explosion of interest in the last year because of COVID. It seems like now people are really thinking about, okay, what can I do for myself and my family? And what am I going to do if my job says I need to show this proof of vaccination and I, for whatever reason, don't want to get it? I need to make a choice. And I've been really talking to my family and friends and trying to get them to think about these intangible terms, not to come from a place of fear, because it's not about fear. Again, I find that if you're being proactive, you have less reason to be afraid anyways. Like, if you know, because I mean, emergencies happen. In Houston, where I'm from, you get hurricanes, you get freak winter storms, things happen, right? And if you don't plan for them, then yeah, you might be afraid because, oh, we didn't think ahead. We're going to run out of gas. We're going to run out of food because we didn't plan. And I believe, and I know that all of our ancestors got us here to these moments that we're in by thinking ahead, by planning for the winter, planning for the next season. And we've kind of gotten to this point where that's demonized. And it's this idea of like, you're a doomsday prepper. If you have like some food put away or something, you know what I mean? It's just, it's silly, but all of our entire history tells us to prepare and to think ahead. But now we have such a convenient life for the most part around the world that you don't really need to think. We don't think in terms of, because the grocery store is right there. It's never going to go anywhere. Why would I need to do anything different? But as we know, those systems are unsustainable. That's the one part the Great Reset does have, is these systems are unsustainable. They just have the wrong solutions. And so if we recognize that these systems are unsustainable, we recognize that potentially we could be locked out of them, then the key, I think, is to build better systems with each other as communities. And this could be building a community garden, building backyard gardens together, or just with people on your street. Whatever it may be, if you're putting away a little bit of food, just as one example, then if the winter storm hits and the power goes out, your family's okay. Or you guys have some solar panels you bought just in case for an emergency, or whatever it may be. The point is that I think the more proactive we are with the situations we're facing, the less fear there is, because you know, you can look at your family, you can look at yourself and say, you know, we don't know what's coming. None of us can tell the future, but I feel good about where we're at. I know that I can take care of my family. I can help my neighbor out. That I'm feeling good, I'm healthy and all these kinds of things. So it's just about being proactive ultimately. And I try to also not use the banking system. That's just for me personally. I mean, there's a lot of different tips and things I could share that for me are about trying to live in line with the systems that I support and the ones I don't support, such as being, you know, vegan. To me, I think that's just an extension of that. So I don't like that the banks robbed the American people and people of the world in 2008 and before that,
right,
and continue to. So I try not to keep my money in those systems, and I stopped using banks in 2008. And so that's just one other example. But to me, ultimately, in the same way that we are living our principles by being vegans, we should apply like that strict kind of discipline with the other principles that we care about in the other parts of our lives.
Yeah, well, very well said. I think when you look at the vegan principles underlying them, it's essentially the basic sense of inclusiveness, like having compassion for all other expressions of life and doing the best we can to have solidarity with each other, not exploit each other and not exploit animals. This looks like to me is a system, the Great Reset, and the way it's coming through a medical kind of fear-based narrative as just to divide and conquer, basically. And so could you say a little bit more about the underlying idea of the freedom cells? Like, it's not about having an internet community then, right? It's about like actual people on in your physical neighborhood. And how important do you think it is that people actually have land as part of it?
Well, so I'll answer both those questions. Yes, Freedom Cells is definitely like a real world thing. You know, we have the website I mentioned, freedomcells.org, but the only, and there's a lot of people organizing in different cells on Telegram as well that are connected to the website. But whether people are in the website or on Telegram, the only reason they exist is to help people find each other so that they can have real world face-to-face meetings. And so our website has a cell map and a members map, and you can go there and put in Houston, Texas, and let me search 25 miles, and it'll show you all the people who have joined within that range or all the cells that are already existing. You can connect to them, say, hey, I'd like to join a meetup. You know, that's the goal. And then get off the website and start, you know, connecting face-to-face and start organizing in your community. So it's definitely a very real-world face-to-face thing, which I think, again, in the midst of what I'm calling COVID-1984 and everything that we're experiencing here, people want face-to-face interactions, especially when we're being told not to show our faces, not to gather in groups, not to, you know, smile and sing and laugh and play around each other. So people, I think, are really craving that connection, which is another reason I think Freedom Cells has really kind of helped facilitate that. But really what we are calling for is for people to organize in groups of eight. There is some different research behind the group number eight and why that's valuable. Essentially just the idea that if we have too many people in certain groups, it could be a little bit too kind of scattered and maybe a little overwhelming. But if you have only a few people, it can be more difficult for bigger projects. And so eight is kind of like an aspirational number. It doesn't mean that you can't organize if you don't have eight people. You only got three people. You just sit around and wait. You know, you organize with what you got, and then you work towards that number. And I've seen people who have been organizing, working on Freedom Cells, particularly in Oklahoma, for years, and there's just this couple of ladies really trying, getting some people's attention, you know, ebbing and flowing, and then COVID came around, and now they ended up with 18 people, so they split off into two different freedom cells, different sides of town, same city, but each kind of meeting, like the more local cells, like your, what we call your inner cadre. Maybe you guys meet once a week, or you talk, you know, online, and you kind of plan things, but then the other cells within your city or your town, y'all can meet maybe once a month and get together, share ideas. Hey, what have you guys been working on? Let's share that. Or you can come together and two cells, which would be 16 people, two groups of eight, you can build a much bigger garden, right? You build a big community garden for your area. I mean, there's just so much potential. And as we're each building these groups in a hyper local way, it gets to the point where they can start to link up for bigger projects. And we really have seen that happen. I mean, I've been giving talks about it since 2016, and we had another website in the past, but it really kind of came together just in the end of 2019, the beginning of 2020, and we've now held 9 different international Freedom Cell conference calls where we'll just, you know, do something like this, and anybody can jump on, and we'll share a little bit of our info, and then we'll let people share, ask questions from different parts of the world. Australia just had their first ever Australian-wide Freedom Cell conference call. We just did our first ever Mexico one about a week and a half ago. And I know a buddy in India who's just been, you know, doing so much good work, especially during COVID, and just talking about truth and just all kinds of different things and using the Freedom Cell network to organize. And so, you know, that doesn't mean that that's the only way people can organize, obviously. And it doesn't even mean you have to call your group a Freedom Cell. We don't really care. It's just about getting organized, getting connected, focusing on solutions. Because as I was saying previously, the more prepared you are, the more proactive you are, then I find like you don't have time to sit around and be paranoid or, you know, afraid. You know, obviously life is we're dealing with some pretty, you know, difficult circumstances here. But I feel like if you are proactive and you are working with other people, then you're going to get that enrichment and that value from just working with other humans, and especially when you can do it with other vegans. I mean, that's one thing. Vegans can go on freedomcells.org, for example, and you can create a Houston vegan freedom cell if you specifically only wanted to work with other vegans and try to recruit other vegans on there. I mean, I know there are a couple of different vegan groups on the website. But so whether vegan or not, the goal is to just network with people. But if that is a principle that is, you know, pretty important to you and you're like, hey, I just, you know, I only want to work with other vegans, use our website, recruit, try to meet other people in your area. Or, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, we used the website or we looked on Telegram and there's nobody in my area. So then it's on you to start it. You got to be the one to start your local freedom cell, so that when somebody else coming after you is going to find you, and then they'll contact you, and then you got two people, and that's just how it starts, you know. But sometimes people, I think, will get discouraged because they want to step into something that's already there and built for them. But sometimes, guys, we got to be the ones to just be the light in our area and step up to the plate and say, okay, I don't know if I'm a leader or whatever, but I'm going to put myself out there. And you'll actually get results from that. You know, you get more results than if you do nothing.
Right. Yeah. Thanks. It's really, I think, the opposite of what they're trying to do with have everybody separate and isolated from each other and afraid and watching the mainstream media. And we actually did it here in where I live in Northern California, in Lake County. We started about, I guess it's been about 2 months, a vegan freedom cell. We have six of us, and but it's really fantastic. We meet every Wednesday. We have a meeting, and we share. We go around the circle. We check in, and then we talk about projects we can work on. We're speaking up every Tuesday morning at the County Board of Supervisors, and you know, giving them hell, and
that's
and
so
people
great.
Want to roll out masks and all this stuff. And so, you know, we're working together for prepping and gardening and all these other things. And we're trying to set up another vegan cell in an adjacent
beautiful.
Town. So I think it's really beautiful to come together, and you can hug each other, and you know you're on the same page. You don't have to be afraid of this sort of this big storm cloud. You know, we're aware there's a storm cloud. It's over us, right? It's here it is. But I'm so really enthusiastic about what you're doing with the Freedom Cells and the greater reset, because I mean, this whole idea is that we're becoming the livestock. It seems like human beings are now looked at. I think we look at animals the way these super rich look at us. Right? It's kind of an interesting mirror thing. Can you say a little bit more also about the idea that of land? I think we want to talk about that, but vegan permaculture, and then maybe you were also mentioning that you are even inviting some people down to Mexico if they want to join something down there, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to hit a couple points here, Will, because there was one other thing I wanted to mention. I think I'm sure we'd want to mention it, is when I was describing the Great Reset, one of the aspects that I forgot to mention that is obviously important to our conversation here is that a lot of the language behind Agenda 2030, Agenda 21, and now the Great Reset is what would appear to be pro-vegan.
Right. That's really important. Yeah.
So it is, there's a lot of what I would deem propaganda, not to say it's not accurate information, but it's done in a way to propagandize people to, you know, push them one direction, about trying to encourage people to be vegan, but I don't consider it to be, you know, Whole Foods be vegan or, you know, whatever terms we want to use. It's definitely what I would consider like a faux vegan, vegan ink kind of, definitely a corporate processed genetically engineered type vegan stuff. And this would be things like, the Bill Gates funded Beyond Beef, Impossible Burgers, those kinds of things. Bill Gates is extensively tied into the World Economic Forum and this Great Reset agenda. And you can look up my reports on that. If you want to verify that, please do your own research, but they are really pushing. You go to the World Economic Forum website and they talk about this, like, oh, how can we have alternatives to beef? And they might even say some of the things that we would agree with, you know, as far as like, hey, the animal industry is doing this and beef is harming this. And you know, you can nod your head like, yeah, this sounds good. And then you see their solutions. Their solutions are 3D printed food. Again, I love 3D printers, but I don't want to eat anything. You know, I think it's an amazing technology, but I don't want to eat a 3D printed anything. Then it's like heavily processed, genetically modified, genetically engineered foods. It's things that they are saying they're, you know, going to grow in a lab. And again, the science behind it sounds pretty interesting when you think of it. Wow, that's a pretty interesting development. But it is not a whole foods healthy. It is not a balanced like vegan diet at all. But that is what they're selling. They're selling is this is the sort of super convenient way to get people from like, hey, you love burgers? We'll just try this Beyond Burger, Impossible Burger, heavily processed. We don't really know exactly what's in it. Burger. And it's not really, there's, for one, I would say also as a vegan, the way they're pushing it, there's no kind of ethics behind it. It's not like, hey, you're harming animals, maybe rethink that. It's just like, you might be able to save the planet if you become vegan, and here's all these sort of technocratic vegan solutions is what it really comes down to. It's not saying, so we're encouraging localized, decentralized permaculture everywhere. We all need community, you know, which would be a much better solution. So I just wanted to make sure we mentioned that, that there is definitely a faux vegan agenda within the Greater Reset. And I think a lot of people who have been coming into the vegan movement might have unwittingly, and this isn't anybody's fault, but just because the propaganda is real, they might have unwittingly been brought into the vegan movement via some of this propaganda, believing that not only like these kind of half measures of Impossible Burger or whatever are going to be good for you in the long term, but that this idea that we should have these people come in to reset the planet because we need to get off meat, et cetera, et cetera. People need to be wary of that. There's a lot of truth mixed with lies and half truths and fabrications. And it's really important for us to question what the motivations behind the people are. So I just wanted to say that before we get into the land aspect.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to mention that what you're saying when you talk about decentralized and people growing their own food and having power over their own food, that's the opposite of what they want. And I think to me, what veganism is, it's about decentralization. It's about empowering people to be healthy. And these foods, these GMO and highly industrialized factory so-called vegan foods, you're going to create a lot of sick people. And that's, to me, it's like the Pentagon thrives on war and the big pharma thrives on sick people, right? They don't want healthy people. The last thing they want is healthy, alert, energetic people who are strong and connected and resisting being dumbed down. And so we have to be very like outraged, I would think, that they're using vegan, like trying to get people, which is the opposite of that. I mean, veganism is the opposite. It's saying I care about myself and my loved ones and about my health and on the spiritual level and ethical level and all these levels, and actually weaseling in and bringing these really toxic, destructive, genetically engineered, industrialized foods where they can easily put in all kinds of graphene oxide or you don't know what's going in there to harm us, and we wouldn't know any better, and to just take away our power. So I'm so glad you're bringing that up, because I think this is a critical point that is people are asleep, and you're really a pioneer to do that. Thanks.
Yeah, yes, I 100% agree with everything you said there, and this kind of just segues perfectly into talking about land and permaculture, veganic permaculture, because to me, I don't know that everybody needs to own land, but I do know that there's value in land. Not only is it because, hey, we get to, you know, care for and take care of a piece of the earth, the planet. This gives us everything that we need. I mean, that's a really, I think, humbling experience. But I do think that historically land is, you know, powerful people. They want to control the land for a reason. They want to own the land and tax you for the rest of your life to live on a piece of the earth because they know that there is power in there. We should add, as we segue into this land conversation, that so I mentioned Bill Gates is one of the people funding the Impossible Burger, the kind of Beyond Burgers. He's also, it's recently been discovered through one of his investment companies, Cascadia Investment, is the largest owner of land, farmland in America. So you got to think about that. The same people that are trying to, as you said, not encourage you to grow your own food and to kind of decentralize, localized food production, but hey, or just stop eating meat and eat this GMO, you know, processed burger, is also buying up all the farmland. And it's because they recognize the value in that. And if you think about that future where you have companies that are creating genetically modified seeds, which are patented and have to be bought and purchased over and over, and then you also have people in that same kind of what I call the predator class buying up all the farmland and then promoting this faux veganism, I mean, you start to see that this picture, like you said, is not one of health. And the true key to health, mental, physical, spiritual health, I do think comes from tending to the earth. Being a caretaker of the earth and learning to grow our own food, obviously being allies and caretakers of the animals as well. And that is something that's become increasingly important to me. You know, I have a grandmother who has a farm in Kentucky. She's born and raised on her farm, and still she's probably in her garden right now. You know, she's in her mid to late 80s, still just working on the garden. And she also has been very awake to a lot of these things. She's been a huge kind of political and spiritual influence to me throughout my life. And she, you know, she just taught me the value of like I said, canning some vegetables and putting it away. Like she sends me veggies. I've got that stored away. And, you know, I think that showed me just when I was younger, but also as I got older and I got to really kind of come to the farm and be there on the land with her and help her plant trees and just spend time there. and then go on my own adventures of kind of volunteering on farms. And then eventually I started a gardening business. And then in the last couple of years, I've got certified as a permaculture instructor. That just showed me that there's so much value. There's so much that comes from when you can take a seed and you can help put it in the earth, cultivate it, take care of it, and then bring it to life. But then also, I mean, of course, the full circle is being able to cook it and serve it for friends. Like, that's to me is like the big thing, right? And there's just so much value there. There's so much to learn. And specifically for us as vegans, there is such a thing as veganic permaculture. You know, this is something that I tried to bring to the table at the second grader reset, because at the first one, you know, we had a permaculture day, I definitely, you know, no sort of downing of any of our speakers, but they're not vegan. So, I mean, obviously they're going to come at it from a different perspective of using animals. And some of them even felt adamantly that, like, hey, you can't do this without animals. And I know that that's not been my experience, and that I've seen other people do it without animals. So I felt like, you know, I want to bring that to the table. And we were able to, I just did some research of my own, and I've been kind of connecting with other vegans who are also permaculture teachers or permaculture students, and really seeing that it is 100% possible that you don't need to exploit animals. And, you know, people might have different kind of lines with that. Like, for example, maybe you are a person that you have chickens and they roam free. You know, they're just, you're not doing anything to them. They're just running around enjoying their lives, right? And they come in, they clean up your garden bed, right? They're just what they're naturally doing, picking, looking for bugs and looking for seeds and whatever else. And they fertilize it with their poop, right? To me, I don't see that as exploitation. If they're just walking around freely in my garden and contributing to that, that would be an example of using an animal or collaborating with, I would say, an animal, as opposed to kind of like, this animal is just here to serve my need. The animal's free to do its thing, and it's also contributing. Like, so, but there might be others who are more extreme than I am and say, hey, I don't want to use any animals in any way. But the point is that there are a lot of options for us out there. I mentioned at my talk, The Greater Reset, one example that I thought was really interesting, and again, this, some folks might not agree, that there was a guy who wanted to use manure, animal manure, but he didn't want to be exploiting animals to get it. Instead, what he did is he started volunteer at an animal sanctuary and a rescue, where obviously animals are going to use the restroom, and then he would take their poop from there and use that on his farm, because he felt like, hey, these animals, I know they're not being exploited. They're, you know, here at a rescue. They're well taken care of. I'm here working with them, and I'm taking their poop and putting it on my garden. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of workaround, as opposed to somebody who's just, they exploit the animals, they use them in all these different ways, and then they use the fertilizer there, where he wanted to say, well, if I'm going to use the fertilizer, I want to make sure that I know that it's not coming from animals that have been abused. So, you know, it brings up a lot of interesting, I think, conversations around it. But the basis of the conversation is that permaculture can definitely be done in a vegan way.
Yeah, that's really important. And I think, you know, we have a veganic food forest here in Northern California, and we have about 70 fruit and nut trees, and we grow a lot of herbs and veggies and everything, and it's totally veganic. Nice. And we're not completely living on that, but we only have like a quarter of an acre here. It's not, under cultivation. But I think there's a lot of wonderful research and actual examples of veganic farms happening and permaculture happening. So this is the way forward, I think. Do you want to say anything about the land possibilities or the community possibilities in Mexico before we close? We're getting kind of at the end of our time here, but
sure. Yeah, I'll definitely share about that. So I think we mentioned I'm in Mexico at the moment. I came to Mexico last March, beginning of COVID. It was sort of already in my plans. Me and my partner Miriam had decided we wanted to get land in Mexico because she has family out here, and we really love the country. And COVID just sort of pushed us to say, you know what, rather than waiting another year or whatever it was our plan, let's go do it now. And so we came out here to Mexico, and we're in Morelia, Michoacán, which is kind of like central Mexico, a couple hours west of Mexico City. And we're up in the hills and the mountains, and we've just been spending the last year looking at different land and also working with a group of people. We're about 12 people to build what I call the Conscious Agora. It's just kind of an idea that I put forward in my third book, which is called Manifesto of the Free Humans. And I had been planning this since 2017 to try to put this into action. And it is specifically a community that is going to be basically living around all the principles we've been talking about today. You know, the idea of self-ownership. We're going to be trying to bring mindfulness into it. That's going to include like group meditations and different practices, but ultimately living with other conscious people who want to keep growing, want to keep learning, people who don't feel like they're static and stuck and, you know, done with the human experience. We want to just grow together and grow, you know, implement permaculture, of course, and do these kinds of things. So We have been meeting for the last year while we've been looking for land. Some of the folks are in Mexico already. Some are still in the U.S. And if all goes well, we came close to getting a property this summer, but we decided to kind of just take some steps back when we realized that, you know, building community is it's a process. And I think a lot of people really, many of us have this aspiration, like, I want to get on the land and go off grid and live with other people. But I've found in my experience last year that not so many people really concretely think about, what does that look like? What does that mean? Are we living in the same house, on the same piece of land, next to each other? You know, how often do we want to see each other? All these different things that you really got to think about when you're talking about community. And so I encourage anybody who is interested in intentional communities and trying to do that to really give it some thought and use networks like freedomcells.org and others to find people who are of like mind, who are serious, who have emotional intelligence and patience and good communication skills to figure out how to collaborate. Because it's a fun, sometimes difficult experience being a human with other humans and navigating that and right. saying, hey, we want to aim for something higher, but we're still humans and, you know. But yeah, it's called the Conscious Agora, and I'm hoping by the end of this year we will be announcing that we have the land and just start building on it. The land that we're looking at is already in a really great condition with lots of fruit trees, and it's got running like fresh spring water and just so many good benefits to it that we hope to turn it as well into a place that can host workshops and can host different events and bring out speakers such as yourself and really talk about these ideas. Not everybody in the community is vegan, but one of our principles that everybody that is going to be living in the community is that there will be no slaughtering of animals on the land. And, you know, people want to eat what they want in their individual home. We're not going to, you know, we can have conversations about it, but we're not going to force that on anybody. And that was just a choice that me and Miriam decided to make, that it felt like we found some good people who, I'd say about just over half are vegan, but it felt like if everybody feels good about what we're trying to build, because we also want it to be an animal sanctuary, then let's do this together. And so, yeah, we've got a good group of people we're working on to build that.
Great. Well, that's a great example. And I think even if people don't feel like they're ready to move to Mexico and join, even think about joining you, it's just an example of what we can do here. We have some friends in the next county over in Mendocino County who are starting a vegan co-housing project and looking for land. So this is something, you know, get some friends, put the word out, find some land together. Moving away, I think, from these cities is probably not a bad idea at this time, the way things are going. So but in closing, this has been amazing, and I know we could talk a lot longer, but can you give us just at the very end just how people can get in touch with you and your work and
sure.
Yeah,
I appreciate, again, the opportunity, Will, to be a part of this. I'm looking forward to hearing from more of the speakers. So my main website, if anybody wants to keep up with like my journalism, interviews, reports, is theconsciousresistance.com. And there's links there to all the different social media that I'm on. If you want to kind of hear more about my backstory, you can just check out derekbrose.com. It's just a place for kind of a long version of my bio. But also I want to make sure we mention this, because by the time this premieres, it will be live, is we have launched the Vegans for Freedom movement that you're a part of this, Will, and basically right. It's just everything we've been talking about today. If you feel aligned with the message we've been sharing today and some of the concerns we have, then you probably would get along with this kind of movement we're hoping to push out there. The website is vegansforfreedom.com, and by the time you guys are hearing this, it will be live, and you can go there. We're going to have a little bit of a description of what we're doing there, and there'll be some resources for people who want to connect. And even if it's just printing out a sticker that says Vegans for Freedom and getting that idea out there and having that conversation. What does that mean to be a vegan that doesn't support the faux veganism and this sort of fake environmental movement? What does that really mean? And I hope people will check it out. So thank you for having me on.
Great. Thank you, Derek. It's a lot of food for thought, really, what you're bringing. And a great example, too. So all the best. Thanks so much.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.